Good morning. Thank you all for coming. In a single remarkable year, a quarter of a century ago, Mary Jo Salter lost her mother, gave birth to a daughter, and had her first collection of poems accepted for publication. Recalling this, I was struck by the way that this constellation of events anticipated three great themes of her work: joy, grief, and the sustaining consolations of art. And not just the art of poetry, but all of them, particularly music and the visual arts. Consider the titles of her first two books, Henry Purcell in Japan and Unfinished Painting. Her mother was the frustrated painter of the portrait in question, and the daughter born that year is now a poet herself, which leads us to another recurrent theme, which we might call matriarchal lineage. At the opening of a long elegy, Dead Letters, Mary Jo is dealing with a junk mail that continues to flow in even after her mother's death. Dear Mrs. Salter, congratulations, you, no need to read on, yet I always do, may have won the sweepstakes if you'll send. The section ends in a daydream in which sometimes I am sent to follow you, my forwarding text, Dear Mrs. Salter's daughter, you are next. Another more hopeful example is a perfect quatrain called Lullaby for a Daughter. Someday when the sands of time invert, may you find perfect rest as a newborn nurses from the hourglass of your breast. 2 years ago, the publication of A Phone Call to the Future, New and Selected Poems, offered us a chance to ponder the depth and breadth of Mary Jo's achievement to date. Though perhaps best known for her poems of happiness, poems of praise, of gratitude, of heartening delight, Mary Jo has endured considerable sorrow as well, but at every point along the way she has known, or figured out rather, what to make of it all. Elegies, light verse, satires, historical narratives, starkly revelatory accounts of her own life, political poems. She's even written a verse play called Falling Bodies about a meeting between the aged Galileo and the young John Milton. In short, she seems capable of almost anything except mediocrity, slackness, or cant. Like Mary Jo herself, the work is delightfully cosmopolitan. Not only has she traveled extensively, but she has also lived for significant periods in France, Italy, Japan, and most unlikely, except perhaps to the mind of her husband, Brad Lighthouser, Iceland. It's regrettable that she was linked early on with a school of poets known as the New Formalists. If I mention them now, it is only to distinguish her from them. For Mary Jo shows what formal mastery really is. In her work, there is no sense of strictness or confinement, the downfall of so much contemporary formal verse. The discipline and difficulty are invisible and inaudible, as they should be. All is fluid, musical, and seemingly effortless. Although she has never taught here, Mary Jo's connections with Amherst College over the years have been many and strong. In fact, our English department has always constituted one of the more enthusiastic chapters of her fan club. We're all grateful for the marvelously diverse and enduring body of work, of course, but also for the exemplary way she has melded the life of the artist with a simple human life, again, apparently without effort. We're delighted to honor her accomplishments this morning, as we will tomorrow morning as well. Please help me welcome Mary Jo Salter.
You how much this morning and this weekend means to me. I just want to ask whether you can hear me.
Yes.
Is this good? There's some water somewhere, but I lost it.
Okay.
Does everyone have a handout? I also have some excerpts from poems, that most of which are old chestnuts, but I thought you'd like to have them in front of you. I've sat through a number of lectures and speeches in my life and have forgotten even the gist of most of them. Who was the main speaker at my own Harvard commencement in 1976? It was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, an important name then, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and later that year to be elected U.S. Senator from New York. But surely his name is worse than forgotten for most of the seniors graduating tomorrow. You can't forget what you never knew. I certainly don't remember, in any case, a single word that the distinguished Mr. Moynihan uttered or any concept he entertained. When I was invited by Amherst College some months ago to give an informal talk this morning, my primary goal was to say something that was at least partly memorable for at least one person in the audience. I wanted, that is, to deliver a memorable speech. Memorable speech, eureka. Wasn't memorable speech W.H. Auden's definition of poetry? I had my subject then, didn't I? Auden is my favorite poet to have been born and died in the 20th century. If he isn't the best on some divinely objective scale, and he may be, he is the modern poet whose half-memorized lines rattle around in my half-conscious head more than those of any other poet. What was that quotation from Auden, his definition of poetry? It was the first sentence from the introduction he and John Garrett wrote to an anthology of poems, The Poet's Tongue, which the two men edited and published in 1935. Here's what Auden says, quote, "Of the many definitions of poetry, the simplest is still the best, memorable speech." If you look up memorable speech on Google, as I did, you will find Auden's sentence cited again and again. You will find learned people in interviews declaring Auden's definition of poetry their personal guidepost. But something about these assertions made me nervous. Let me quote Auden again. "Of the many definitions of poetry, the simplest is still the best, memorable speech." Using quotation marks around the phrase, Auden was signaling that it was not he who coined it. And he'd observed that the simplest definition is still the best, meaning once again that he was saluting somebody else's definition. Whose? It was the work of only a few more minutes to find, not by memory, Lord knows, but through further trolling on the internet, the phrase's originator. It was the critic Sir Arthur Quiller Couch in a lecture he gave at the University of Cambridge on Wednesday, February 26, 1913. Yes, we can even affirm without the least uncertainty that the best definition of poetry was first released to the world on a Wednesday. And we can also pronounce that exactly 5 days before Cambridge men in black robes were listening to Quiller Couch's words, W.H. Auden, then living in the city of York, celebrated his birthday. He was 6 years old. Back to the University of Cambridge. In the third of a series of talks, this one called On the Difference Between Verse and Prose, which Quiller Couch would publish in book form in 1916, and Auden must have read a good deal later, the lecturer declares, "Literature, the written word, is a permanent record of memorable speech, a record, at any rate, intended to be permanent." Now, this was interesting. The record Quiller Couch envisioned was that of speech. After all, poetry began as an oral art long before writing was invented. In literature, literally letters, what is being recorded is what might once only have been spoken. And what is being recorded so memorably and with such tender attachment is not life, but speech, that is, words. Recorded memorably? But I apparently had gotten everything wrong. I had retained the wrong author of the phrase. And now it turned out that Quiller Couch's definition was not of poetry, as Auden seemed to think, and therefore I thought, but of literature. And it gets worse, I'm afraid. Quiller Couch specifically says he doesn't even want to use the word poetry. Here's another kernel insight. You observe that I avoid the term poetry. If we restrict ourselves to the terms verse and prose, we shall find the line much easier to draw. Verse is memorable speech set down in meter with strict rhythms. Prose is memorable speech set down without constraint of meter and in rhythms both lax and various, unquote. What a disappointment. What Sir Arthur actually said is something so nuanced, perhaps even hair-splitting, that it is not memorable. Both verse and prose are memorable speech? So what, and how can that help us? And why does Auden misremember this definition as the simplest, and why does he assert that it applies only to poetry? Well, Auden is human, like the rest of us, and even at the tender age of 28, when he writes his introduction with his now forgotten collaborator, Mr. Garrett, he misremembers. Though nothing ever has been or will be more memorable than metered poetry, as any child who taps her foot to a nursery rhyme knows, As anyone who sings along to old standards on the radio knows, what is potentially memorable, even in poetry or in lectures about poetry, is not necessarily memorized. We define literature as what is memorable but misremember literature. We misremember events in our lives too, as you may remember. I'm finding my way here to a thesis. I'm going to propose that if we remembered accurately, there could be no literature. Certainly, there could be no poetry. I should underline a distinction. Verse itself is mostly memorable. As Quiller Couch reminded his audience nearly a century ago, the word ballad means song to us, but it once also meant dance, as in ballroom. Verse itself is song and dance. It's an act we learn to perform, to appreciate, to remember by repeated practice. The words of verse, tatum tatum, rhyme upon rhyme, yes, are memorable. But I would argue that the substance of poetry, the subject matter, the tone and imagery through which the poet presents the subject matter, all depend mightily upon different gifts, and among these gifts is our capacity to misremember and forget. There are 9 muses, we were told at school. The muse of memory, Mnemosyne, reaches back into the past. But the moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on, and the further it moves on, the more it gets the little things wrong. William Wordsworth, one of the world's most indefatigable memoirists, and arguably the first truly modern one, died at 80 just before the final version of his long verse autobiography, The Prelude, or Growth of a Poet's Mind, a title he did not choose himself, was published in 1850. To Wordsworth, remembering was everything. And what was modern about him began with his thought that you ought to be interested in everything he remembered and even in what he forgot. He worked on and off on The Prelude, though he hadn't, as a young poet, known it would be his major endeavor, for over 50 years. The experiences of childhood, to Wordsworth, are our signal experiences, though we may not understand them until later. He held the conviction that we would understand later, and that such interpretations set down in verse would be useful, his word, to his readers. In thinking about poetry, Wordsworth had some brilliant insights, sitting down to write his great manifesto, the preface to Lyrical Ballads, which he produced with Samuel Taylor Coleridge at the turn of the 18th century into the 19th. I wish I could read the whole thing to you right now, but I'll limit myself to a few phrases and paraphrases. Writing in the height of the Industrial Revolution, Wordsworth fretted that the crowded cities instill in people an appetite for extraordinary incident, and that the rapid communication of intelligence hourly gratifies that appetite, which thereby reduces humanity to a savage torpor. Get that, a complaint about rapid information technology and sensationalism and ennui 200 years before the internet. Wordsworth added that we must hold on to our capacity to be moved by delicate and nuanced things, not by what he called gross and violent stimuli. Wordsworth also said that the poet is the man, who writes of absent things, but who manages to conjure up in himself such a passion that he actually feels those absent things more keenly than the average person feels present things. Absent, that is, means either not in this place or not in this time, or both. This space-time vision of Wordsworth's is, I think, a particularly futuristic touch. I want to pause, too, at Wordsworth's famous insight in The Prelude that each of us experiences spots of time, moments that imprint themselves on us early and revisit us with shifting and deepening meaning. You'll see this excerpt on your handout, and I'll only quote an excerpt from that excerpt. There are in our existence spots of time that with distinct preeminence retain a renovating virtue. Spots of time. The camera wasn't invented yet when Wordsworth wrote these lines, though it had been invented by the time he died. But even in that year, 1850, the camera's exposures still took a long time. People were actually put in neck braces to hold their heads steady while the camera took a full 30 seconds to immortalize them. We were a long way off from the Polaroid, a fact which helps render Wordsworth's insight into the flash-like mechanism of memory so profound. Probably the most common metaphor for memory in modern writing is the snapshot. As we've seen in Wordsworth, the notion that the remembered thing essentially stands still predates the invention of photography. so does the notion of a flash of memory. In one of his short lyric poems, "I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud," Wordsworth lies brooding on his couch and is cheered up by recalling the sight of daffodils. Remembering these absent things more keenly than the average man sees present ones, he is the quintessential poet. And this is the second excerpt at the bottom. "They flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils." Memory as something that stands still. Memory as a flash. As I say, these concepts predated the invention of photography. But once that technology was invented, the symbol of the flash-assisted, self-sufficient snapshot became irresistible. Interestingly, in all the years, more than a century, since the invention of motion pictures, the metaphor of memory as a snapshot or a scrapbook of snapshots, well or badly kept, hasn't lost its power. We watch movies today much more than we look at stills. Yet there is something about moving images, however artfully edited, that suggests they are too much like life to be like memory. As Wordsworth said in a completely different context, the world is too much with us. And so the moving image isn't selective enough, it's everything. We like the figure of memory as a snapshot because a snapshot is a document, a thing in your hand, even if that thing is only your cell phone with a little screen, a thing that serves as a reality test. Yet we also like documents because, when we're honest, we have to admit that all documentation at some level, some exciting level, lies. Joseph Brodsky, the Russian poet and Nobel laureate who died 14 years ago, and who was my colleague for some of the years I taught at Mount Holyoke College, wrote repeatedly about memory. In an insight that swirls around often in my own head, he observed, "Memory betrays everybody, especially those whom we knew best. It is an ally of oblivion. It is an ally of death. It is a fishnet with a very small catch, with the water gone." Brodsky's perceptions about memory may well derive, at least in part, from his being the son of a photographer father he admired. In a number of essays, Brodsky likens memory to a snapshot. Brodsky also admired Robert Lowell, an American poet who died in 1977, not long after Brodsky's expulsion from Russia to the West. Robert Lowell wrote near the end of his life a poem in which memory is seen as a snapshot. Look at an excerpt from this now famous poem, Epilogue, which you see on your handout. "But sometimes everything I write with the threadbare art of my eye seems a snapshot, lurid, rapid, garish, grouped, heightened from life, yet paralyzed by fact. All's misalliance. Yet why not say what happened?" It's hard to say to what degree Lowell's method is consciously, artfully clueless here. Some of the phrasing seems such a deliberate repudiation of his own lifelong craftsmanship that it sounds downright sloppy, as in that line, "But sometimes everything I write." Sometimes everything? Not very good. And what about the poet's question, "Yet why not say what happened?" That certainly sounds naive. Doesn't Lowell know that nobody actually knows what happened? Although Epilogue is far from my favorite of Lowell's poems, I like to hope he knew what he was doing here. Life's disconnectedness, presented artfully, with just enough connective tissue, as in the line we just heard, "lurid, rapid, garish, grouped," distinguished Lowell's best autobiographical poems, especially in his 1959 volume called Life Studies. The fish of Lowell's life were netted in that book, but, to return to another of Brodsky's metaphors, some of the water in which they lived is still there. Let's decide it is established in any case that memory consists of snapshots and that snapshots lie. They may be unmarked or mismarked. Even clearly remembered moments floating in life-giving water drift downstream and out of context. We are perplexed looking at our snapshots, at the elevation to importance of a thing simply because it is recorded. We wish, in contrast, that we could record a thing simply because it is important. And maybe, what really becomes important to us is not the memory, but the memory of the memory. Looking over our snapshots, our oddly selected memories, again and again, we worry that other experiences, not being photographed or written about and thus reconsidered, are lost forever. Who can confirm for us, in Lowell's words, what happened? No matter how many albums of snapshots or how many scrapbooks of ticket stubs or playbills or report cards we keep, the vast majority of our experience cannot be tested by any external source. Asking other people for help is no good. They misremember in their own way. Let me repeat, though, what I take as consolation. If we remembered perfectly, there could be no literature. One definition of literature, for today anyway, might be that it is a verbal artifact with the humane aspiration to record truthfully our misreading, mishearing, falling victim to optical and other sensory illusions of all kinds, and, most importantly, of misunderstanding. To record truthfully. I use the word truthfully just then after much debate with myself. I don't mean that literature is necessarily sincere or earnest or factual, or that it necessarily seeks or achieves verisimilitude. I mean that we recognize in literature something arrived at that is something like the truth in some way, often by the back door or by distortion. Our familiarity with truth in an ordinary day of routines and automatic responses is so minimal that the backdoor truth that literature provides is actually, pathetically, an improvement. Good old Ernest Wordsworth, in an early version of The Prelude, recounts a misunderstanding that may be useful to us here. He writes that at the age of 7, coming upon a heap of garments by a lakeside and no people, he had not understood that a man had drowned in the lake, until adults with their mysterious tools dredged up the corpse. I'll quote that moment of remembered trauma, which is on your handout. The succeeding day there came a company, and in their boat sounded with iron hooks and with long poles. At length the dead man, mid that beauteous scene of trees and hills and water, bolt upright rose with his ghastly face. The shock is even more vivid on the page, partly due to the poet's wise decision to place the arresting phrase, bolt upright, at the end of one line, and the phrase, rose with its ghastly face, with that capitalized rose, opening the next line. The dead face emerges almost literally from the flat surface of the poet's notebook. It rises, too, from the deliberately bland words that preceded it, mid that beauteous scene of trees and hills and water, which offers us a picture so vague that it is a verbal equivalent of a blurry black background in a snapshot, a background to the dead body in the focused foreground. Here is one of the most vivid moments in Wordsworth's writing, and yet it's a mediated experience. It, too, is blurred. It shows a man of understanding, a man skilled with his camera, trying to see from the perspective of a child who is squinting, the child who is blindsided, shocked, to encounter death itself. At the risk of irritating you with a comparison Brodsky never meant, I have to stress how interesting I find it that Wordsworth's traumatic, poetically accomplished memory is of a drowned man being fished out of the water. If memory is usually a good deal drier than life, as Brodsky implies, a fish in a net with the water gone, the recovered corpse in Wordsworth is a catch that is really soaked, utterly drenched with context. The critic Carlos Baker wrote an introduction to The Prelude about 100 years after its completion. In this essay of 1948, Baker considers Wordsworth's views on how the mind combines sensory impressions with later reflections. Baker also writes of another doubleness. Wordsworth, he said, often juxtaposes two widely separated periods of time in such a way that we are made dramatically conscious of the degree of growth that has taken place between stage one and stage two. It resembles the effect that might be produced by our seeing a double exposure on photographic film, where the same person appears in the same setting, except that 10 years have elapsed between exposures. Taking my pencil to mark this passage in an old paperback recently, I suddenly realized that I had already marked it in a now faded ink. When had I done that? Not when it was a fresh idea in 1948. I wasn't born yet. I must have admired Baker's sentences in about 1974, when I was studying Wordsworth in college. Now, 36 years later, I was experiencing another sort of double exposure. I was the same person with the same book in my hand, but so profoundly a different person that any decent photographer would have had to throw out the double exposure as unsellable. I should point out that the book of Wordsworth's poems has changed too. In my young adulthood, it was composed of fresh white paper. Now the pages are brittle and yellow. And the language of the mid-20th century critic, however insightful it remains, has now become to me almost as old-fashioned as Wordsworth's language. Listen again to what Baker says in 1948 about Wordsworth's technique. It, quote, resembles the effect that might be produced by our seeing a double exposure on photographic film. The formality of the vocabulary, photographic film, the now over-scrupulous definition of that common occurrence, a double exposure, probably seemed natural enough to me in 1974. Yet so much time has passed since then that I cannot be sure that 100% of the youngest listeners in this room today know what a double exposure is. Everybody once knew that a double exposure happens when you forget to click the lever on the camera that advances the film. Advances, that's interesting. The future is supposed to represent an advance. Carlos Baker's words now live in a different world than they once did. In 2010, I'm used to a more conversational style from the critics I like. For instance, the work of Amherst professor William Pritchard. I write more conversationally, more naturally than I used to. Something Wordsworth thought he was doing too. Is that better? Is that an advance? In any case, it's worth noting in our technological age that the double exposure was once a new thing, then a common thing, then a forgotten thing. You don't get double exposures on cell phones and digital cameras. In rereading Mr. Baker, what I really experienced was a triple exposure. Remote past, near past, and something like the present, with an outdated metaphor to express it. We poets get old and older. We don't necessarily get wiser, as Wordsworth seems to hope. But poets are more childish than other adults, and that, to me, is some consolation. In place of accurate memories, we embrace, seek out, embellish inaccurate perceptions. My daddy took me to Africa yesterday in a taxi, a 4-year-old resident of the town of Amherst once announced to me. That cheerful, spontaneous lie is more poetic than anything you or I are likely to come up after thinking all week. And the child doesn't just make up plot lines. What he does to language itself is also offhandedly but intensely poetic. You tell a child, for instance, that we have a lot of computers nowadays, and she asks you, what did they have then-a-days? If you're an adult poet, you borrow. Hearing a coinage like this, then-a-days, I may write it down, use it somehow, as I have just now used my older daughter's phrase from long ago in this lecture. Since, however, the adult poet is not a child and can't count on there being a child chattering nearby all the time, the poet relies heavily on dreams, night dreams and daydreams. Many of us write down an idea when it is still as confusing as can be, that is, when it is in its most literary form. At first come the words we dream onto the page, and it is in the nature of dreams that we misremember the way the world really is. We did not meet Paul McCartney last night, an event I must truthfully tell you that I have dreamed repeatedly since 1964, though with decreasing frequency. And even if we traveled from Amherst to Africa, we did not get there in a taxi. It's easy to lament that we are no longer children, those natural poets who don't hesitate to lie. But bodily decrepitude is wisdom, wrote Yeats, and in my own aging, I take solace in the gifts of my decrepitude, the poetically useful misperceptions that belong to the over 50 set. My eyesight has been getting worse, and I am constantly misreading. Not long ago in Maryland, I misread an ad for the Chesapeake Bank as being for the Cheapskate Bank. I have to use that in a poem, I thought. The other day in Chicopee, I read a sign that claimed, duality is affordable. Though this may be a profound insight, perhaps attributable to Hegel, I was surprised to be encountering it in front of an appliance repair shop in Chicopee. Then I corrected my vision. It was not duality that was affordable, but quality. One letter, D for Q, can make a world of difference for the poet trying not to lose her childhood gift of misunderstanding. My hearing is worsening now, too, and in my despair, I find excellent, if accidental, occasions for rhyme because my ear supplies one letter for another. Listening to a radio broadcast of an opera recently, I heard the announcer say in the synopsis that the hero wears engines. Wears engines, I asked my husband. What the heck does that mean? No, he explained, the hero swears vengeance. Poetry loves pairings of all kinds, the pairings of metaphor and the pairings of rhyme. But though it loves pairings, poetry is rather bored with identical twins. If my love were really actually a red, red rose, then that wouldn't be much of an image for her. When we read about her, the human lover, we want to think first about how she is like a rose, sweet-smelling, skin soft as rose petals, wit like a sharp thorn. And then, consciously or not, we want to take pleasure in where the likeness stops. For one thing, she isn't red. Rhyme is a special case, if we think of this technique both as a kind of remembering and of misremembering. The poet relies on the reader's oral memory, always did so, since the first preliterate songs. In the case of exact rhyme, the second word is only one sound off, like the first mistake in a game of telephone. I say tree, you hear three. The reader hears the niceness of the problem, appreciates the right-wrongness, at once if the lines are adjacent, as in a rhyming couplet. Furthermore, tree sounds like three. Tree doesn't mean three. In the right poet's hands, we may like that. The longer the distance between two rhymed lines, the less we can be expected to remember the N words that came before, although we can be trained by a professor in a classroom or just by ourselves reading aloud to hear them and see them. We can be trained to appreciate in a highly unphonetic language like English how rhymed words may not be spelled the same, or unrhymed words may be much closer in spelling than the rhymed ones. We can be trained to appreciate the wavering but patterned distances between pairings in a complicated rhyme scheme. We can be trained to relish the very faintness of memory. Exact rhymes such as tree and three suggests, among other things, a clear memory of the sound you voiced a line or some lines ago. Inexact or slant rhyme, a pairing of two words like life and if, may suggest to some readers that the poet is forgetful, careless, that she's not trying hard enough to remember where she is and where she's been. But the careful poet may deliberately allow that slant rhyme to stand, and will even seek more of them, as a commentary first on the qualities of her particular language, and second on her experience of experience, so to speak. Life really is an if, isn't it? Among the many things we experience and misremember, I want to consider for the rest of this talk literature itself. Let's recall what Quiller Couch said. Literature is memorable speech, not memorable life. Writers and other literary people remember books. For us literary types, professors and critics and students and gloriously unaffiliated readers who can't wait to get home from the office to read Proust or Nabokov, literature doesn't just express something about life, it becomes life, or almost. I made the grand declaration a while back that if we remembered everything accurately, there could be no literature. And because anything we do in life is misremembered, literature, that record of misremembering and misunderstanding, gets misremembered too. The literature we have absorbed in our lifetimes gets jumbled, seems partly or wholly erased, goes underground, and then gets rearranged and rewritten. We are indebted to everything we've ever read and can't consciously remember reading, all the books that have melded together in our heads. For me, the poets who are thankfully ineradicable include Shakespeare and Milton, and also a few poets of my own time, poets such as the late James Merrill and the greatest living poet in English, Richard Wilbur. Both of these great American poets, Merrill and Wilbur, born within a few years of each other, are Amherst College graduates, by the way, and given the small size of this institution, that's astonishing. In any case, the writers we love, even when we misremember or misquote them, were there in our minds, and that means they're here. So, for some of us, literature really is life. That was true for Vladimir Nabokov, the 20th century novelist and poet who wrote in both Russian and English, and also produced one of the great prose memoirs of our era. It happens to be one of the least convincing on a purely factual level. I doubt that Nabokov was thinking of Auden's or Quiller Couch's definition of poetry as memorable speech when he wrote his autobiography, but I'm finding it handy this morning that he happened to entitle his book Speak Memory. Nabokov is so extreme an example of the writer whose life is art that he goes so far as to declare, "The following of thematic designs through one's life should be, I think, the true purpose of autobiography." Reading such a declaration, you might think that he thinks he's writing a novel. In other words, even when one is writing about real-life events remembered quite well, and Nabokov has an enviably precise memory of the smallest daily details of childhood, this writer feels that one is obliged to shape these recollections thematically, poetically, so that they seem shaped by an omniscient hand. the hand not of God the creator, but the writer himself. A central theme of Nabokov's childhood, by his account, in this case quite believable, is his bookishness. Another theme is expressed by an image, the crack of light that is our brief existence. Nabokov also uses the metaphor of a slideshow. Here's another slide from my life, he says, as he opens chapter after chapter, and he shows us the flashes of light, the seemingly photographed moments of his recollections. But something else is going on here, too. It's Nabokov's internalizing of Marcel Proust's novel, In Search of Lost Time, his appropriation of that writer's method and imagery as if by dream work. But oh dear, the time for this lecture is running out. I'm talking about memory in modern literature particularly, and now I'm only just mentioning Proust. How could I be so foolish? On the other hand, I think Proust would forgive me. He worked in circles, and he sometimes picked up later what he missed the first time. Experiences reminded him of other experiences, things he thought he had forgotten but hadn't entirely. The mechanism of involuntary memory, as Proust phrased it, was achieved by means of the senses. Most of you in this room know that it was the experience of tasting a Madeleine cake with a spoonful of lime blossom tea that unfolded for Proust's narrator, unwittingly and involuntarily, though not unpleasantly, his hometown of Cambrai. Proust's narrator is himself profoundly bookish too, an artistic boy and man whose most vivid experiences of life are found in reading and looking at pictures and listening to music and going to the theater. On the first page of Proust's long novel, the narrator, sleepily dropping a history book he has taken to bed, confuses himself that he is a character or a historical figure in the book. Proust's opening is a marvelous evocation not only of what a hypnagogic state feels like, but of the condition of bookishness. For some of us, literature is life. A still visual image infused with and transformed by light, a magic lantern or a stained glass church window in Proust, a slideshow in Nabokov. Memory flickers unreliably in those windows for all of us, and the writer in his fifth or 50th draft finally embraces his prerogative, which we don't have in life, of deciding which of the many deceptive slides we should look at in which order. He may even choose to slip some of the slides into the projector, remember slide projectors, upside down or backwards. And some of the brightest slides may be reproductions of illustrations he found in books. Is there a real world we can stub our toe on if we kick it? And if so, why should it be literature, which records in symbols the insubstantial medium of speech that convinces us we've remembered it? You don't know there's a real world, perhaps, until you're all alone with it. Robinson Crusoe on his island knows there's a real world because if he doesn't get something to eat today, nobody else will get it for him and he's going to die. Daniel Defoe's Adventure of a Man in Lonely Extremity is one of the most vividly imagined stories in the history of the world, and many writers of successive generations have grappled with Robinson Crusoe almost as if that book itself, not just food and shelter, is a key to survival. The American poet Elizabeth Bishop, who lived in Brazil for many years and died in Boston in 1979, was one of these writers. In her late poem, Crusoe in England, she writes from the perspective of Crusoe narrating his life after he has been rescued and taken back home, if that's what England is. Crusoe's frustrations before he was rescued, in Bishop's eyes, included his inability to remember poetry accurately, and thus his inability to entertain or inform himself. You'll see the passage on your handout. Why didn't I know enough of something? Greek drama or astronomy? The books I'd read were full of blanks. The poems, well, I tried reciting to my iris beds. They flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss. The bliss of what? One of the first things that I did when I got back was look it up. What is the line Crusoe is trying to call up? I read it to you just minutes ago. It's from William Wordsworth, from that moment when he's all alone on his couch and remembers the daffodils. Not the irises, though Bishop's choice of flower here is a nice remember of the iris of the inward eye. They flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude, is what Wordsworth said. How ironic, how delicious. The word that Bishop's Crusoe can't remember is solitude, the one thing he has plenty of. And it gets more ironic than that. Robinson Crusoe was published in 1719. William Wordsworth was born in 1770. The real Robinson Crusoe, if a literary character can be said to exist, and I think he can, couldn't possibly have remembered poems Wordsworth hadn't written yet. But Elizabeth Bishop is Daniel Defoe, of course, and she is Robinson Crusoe. If we care to be biographical, we can also note, sadly, that she once called herself a minor female Wordsworth, and she was certainly much better than that. It is no defect at all that her poem chooses to employ an anachronism. In fact, the poem is better for it. If poetry as memorable speech means anything, no matter who came up with this definition, Auden or Quiller Cooch or you or I, it suggests that having a highly developed memory is one of the distinguishing features of humanity. Memory is perhaps as much of a distinction for us among all animal species as poetry writing itself. But memory isn't perfect, and poems that are too perfect, too neat, lie in ways that we distrust instantly. The truth isn't either or. As they say in Chicopee, duality is affordable. We trust Bishop Crusoe's faulty memory partly because we're all in this together, remembering and forgetting lines, forgetting who said what. Late in Auden's 1935 essay, he writes something I hope you and I will remember. The test of a poet is the frequency and diversity of the occasions on which we remember his poetry. Bishop remembered and misremembered Wordsworth because she kept going back to him in double, in triple, indeed countless exposures. But none of us can remember what we don't read. The test of each of us as readers is the frequency and diversity of occasions in which we are in a position to remember poetry at all. Thank you.
Research to show that fans at a baseball game, the fans of the team that loses remember more than the fans of the team that wins.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I'm wondering if that has any reflection in poetry.
Wow. I wish I talked to you before my lecture. I really think that's profound. I mean, it suggests, I guess one of the things that it makes me think of is how misrepresentative journals can be, or diaries can be. Because many of us, and I include myself, I don't write much in a diary, I rarely do. But if I do, it is usually because I'm unhappy, and I need to get it all out. So if one were to read the collected diaries of so-and-so, whoever we are, we might get a very misrepresentative view what memory is or what the experience was, what the experience was. But I really have to think about this with losing the game. Because, and it's true with reviews. If you ask the writer, you know, how were the reviews for your book, you always remember the negative ones. You can't remember when anybody said it was positive. It's true. Well, thank you, everybody.
It was like, it seems to me the poetic expression of that is Casey F.